philosophy to an interested and educated audience. We try to choose topics that are interesting to the people that come to it, diverse, challenging. You are well informed, you ask good questions, so we try to cater to that. Some of the upcoming lectures that we have this spring, Confronting Death, Compassion, the Value of the 21st Century, we'll see. Free Will versus Determinism. Anyway, there's a web page, Dallas Philosophers Forum, or the Meetup page. They also have calendars, so you can look, see what might interest you, and hope to see you back.
Yeah. David? I'll pick one up.
Oh, yeah, you got them pretty good. Oh,
yeah,
they're all on there?
Yeah, they're right here.
Okay, cool.
After the last one, we don't have it.
Okay, that's important. David Drum is our treasurer. He'll be happy to receive your admission fees if you hadn't paid yet. $5 if you're a card-carrying student. I don't believe you're here.
It'd be $2.
If you're a card-carrying student.
No, but are there any here? Seems like there's a little more my age. We've been meeting at LPNICS for a number of years, and management's been kind enough to provide us this date. I believe you said 2009.
I believe that's
about
what
10
it is.
Years now. Yeah. And it's a wonderful room that they don't rent out like this to people anymore. We are grandfathered in it. Many of us are grandparents, so I guess that's appropriate. If you order food or drink, please remember to pay your bill so that we don't have to, and tip the wait staff. Tonight's lecture will take about 45 minutes and will be followed by a Q&A, as long as we're willing to stay, as long as we're out of here before 9 o'clock. To give the speaker time to answer, please frame your question as a question rather than as a dissertation. Tonight's speaker is Dr. Pankaj Jain. I think I said it right. Dr. Jain was born in India. He got his undergraduate degree there in computer science. He moved to New Jersey in 1966, getting an M.A. in religion. From, excuse me?
96.
What did I say? Oh, yeah. My age is showing.
I don't think I'm
getting an M.A. in religion from Columbia University in New York and a Ph.D. in religious studies from the University of Iowa. He's currently editing the Hinduism section for the Encyclopedia of Indian Religions and Indian and Western Philosophical Concepts in Religion. He's also writing a book on the history of Jains and Hindus in the Americas. His two published books are Science and Socio-Religious Revolution in India, Moving the Mountains in 2017, and Dharma and Ecology of Hindu Communities, Sustenance and Sustainability in 2011. He's associate professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Texas, where he teaches courses on religions, cultures, ecologies, and films of India and Asia. Tonight he'll be speaking about environmental history of Dharmic communities. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jain.
So delighted to be here. I was supposed to be here at this forum about 3 or 4 years back, and with deep regrets, I could not make it that time. I'm very happy to be here tonight and very grateful for your invitation, for your gracious introduction. 1966, I was not even born.
That's not so long ago.
Tonight's talk is on, you get, I think, second talk on Indian philosophy, touching on Indian philosophical issues in a very short time. I learned that you had another speaker also on a similar topic. But tonight's topic is on where the words such as philosophy and religion and environmental ethics, all these words are obviously English words, but people in several countries such as India and China, Japan, Africa, all these words are really intertwined. They are really overlapping, where philosophy stops and religion begins, or vice versa. Is hard to tell. It's philosophy, it's religion, it's environmental ethics, it's really way of life in a different way. You know, just a different way. Imagine if a community where everybody just born into vegetarianism, You don't have to become a vegetarian, but you're just born into vegetarianism. A philosophy where nobody's fully right, nobody's fully wrong. Everybody's partially right. What will that do to the world? Philosophy where the monks in this community, even today, there are two sects, I'll touch upon those two sects. The monks of one sect, still today, go completely nude, completely naked. Not a single possession on their body. So they've renounced all kinds of possessions. Obviously, they've renounced their family, they've renounced their wealth, but also their clothing itself. It's the ultimate form of renunciation, the ultimate form of monkhood, still exists, even today, in these communities, mostly in India. So that's a kind of a really radically different way of life, even from my own, even though I was born into this tradition. My father tries to practice this philosophy. My mother tries to practice Hinduism. So I got the both sides of the coin, Hinduism and Jainism in India, from India. But my own lifestyle is, I still am vegetarian, but I'm not, I cannot even, you know, imagine matching up to the standards that monks or some of the really orthodox people in India are practicing these ideas. So something to, I guess, as a reminder to myself and to share what they have been doing for the last at least 2600 years, 2600 years, when Buddha was born. Buddha and Mahavira, the last great teacher of this community was Mahavira. He was the contemporary of the Buddha. Buddha everybody knows, right? At least the name is very familiar. But Mahavira is not so well known. But Mahavira and the Buddha, they can be seen as two counterparts, two contemporaries, two giants who profoundly changed the Indian way of living, Indian way of thinking, and through Buddhism, then eventually it influenced entire Asia, China and Japan, Cambodia, Mauritius, Thailand, Singapore, wherever Buddhism went, vegetarianism went with Buddhism to across to entire Asia. And now with Buddhism, now that it has come to North America, also many people have turned to becoming vegetarians or even vegan, which I am not. I'm just vegetarian. It's very hard to be vegan. So this is the philosophy that this and Buddhism, Jainism and Buddhism, are the two main, we can say, two front wheel of a car that rides on vegetarianism. So this idea of vegetarianism started with Mahavira and the Buddha, even more than Buddha, Mahavira. So this is the kind of a preface, and then I'll get into more details as we go on.
It has to be on first.
Right. Other way to look at this philosophy is this philosophy itself calls itself non-violence. Non-violence is the supreme philosophy. Non-violence is the supreme religion. Non-violence is the supreme or ultimate virtue. All these words are used within this philosophy. So the idea of non-violence to this country especially is, I think, synonymous with Dr. Martin Luther King, who launched a civil rights movement in late 60s and 70s. But Martin Luther King himself was so inspired by Gandhi that he actually went to India in, I think, early 70s. And he visited the place where Gandhi lived. And then he tried to model his movement in footsteps of Gandhi. Gandhi himself was inspired by this philosophy of Jainism. So Mahavira. So Mahavira to Mahatma Gandhi. So Mahavira was the contemporary of the Buddha. Mahavira to Mahatma, and from Mahatma to Mate. So it's a philosophy of three M's. Mahavira, the contemporary of the Buddha, Mahatma Gandhi everybody knows, and then Martin Luther King. So Mahavira, Mahatma, and Martin. So that's another way to look at the relevance of Jainism. Why Jainism is relevant? Because of the idea of nonviolence, which became very, very influential as America was shaping up after 70s especially. So we'll take a look at some of the key ideas of this philosophy, Jain philosophy, eco-examples, how the community has lived without calling themselves as environmentalist, or without even using the word ecology or climate change or global warming, how this community, how this philosophy has shaped their worldview. So I'll try to give you some examples and what they are doing today, and then the final conclusion. So environmental issues in India are also very, not very good. I mean, there are a lot of problems, a lot of issues are happening. or what is the Jain cosmology or ethics towards the nature? We will take a look at that. What is the Jain worldview and contemporary theories, how they compare, and how Jains, those who are practicing these ideas, how they respond to environmental issues. We'll take a look at that. So issues are very serious. In India also, there is assault on land, loss of forest, industrial pollution, unplanned urbanization, large-scale projects and less rehabilitation of displaced. Rivers are getting polluted, and population explosion, obviously, 1.35 billion people in less than one-fourth land that we have in America. So less than a fourth of the land, but more than four times, almost four times more people. So that kind of a crunch of resources. So some of the problems are probably familiar to us also, especially in Pittsburgh in the 1940s. We had similar kinds of pollution, but we took care of our cities by strong laws and EPA and all that. Ohio's river in 1960s had similar pollution, but again, we took care of our rivers right here in America because of our strong laws, EPA, and we cleaned up our water and air. India has to do similar things also to clean its rivers. So that's one picture of India's environmental issues. But on the other hand, there's another picture also from about India's environment that comes to us from National Geographic Survey's Green Index. It compares the carbon footprint of all the major economies of the world, and India continues to be at the top, the greenest country in the world. Why? Because India's carbon footprint continues to be the lowest, even less than China, Brazil, South Africa, Russia, and definitely much less than United States or many European countries or Australia. Why? Because much of India's people, Indian people, even today, are living in houses they may never have central AC, for example, central air conditioning, 24/7 hot water or centrally heated houses. The water needs are still very less because water is very scarce already in India. The dwelling sizes are still much less, much smaller, and three generations, joint families are still living in those small houses. So because of the less consumption of resources, carbon footprint continues to be less when it comes to housing needs. Transportation, similarly, people are still either walking, biking, taking public transport, transportation, or carpooling and so on. So the ownership of cars is still less than any other country in the world. So carbon footprint remains less than other countries. But most important to this topic today is food. Most of Indians, their main diet still consists of rice, lentils, beans, wheat, and other grains. People who do take meat or egg, they will take it maybe once a week or once a month. It's kind of a special meal for many Indians, for most Indians. So India still can be regarded as the most vegetarian country in the world. So now we know from latest scientific researches that one of the biggest reasons for climate change, one of the biggest reasons for carbon footprint is meat consumption. Meat, growing of the meat, growing food for the cattle, that food comes at a great cost because the Amazonian forest, for example, have to be cleared off so that farming can be done. That food that goes to the cattle, that then cattle will consume that food, and after we slaughter our cattle, that meat gets transported across thousands of miles, and that all that costs a lot of carbon footprint. So because meat consumption is so low in India, again, that's a third reason that carbon footprint remains very low in India. The fourth parameter is consumer goods. That's also consumed at a much less rate than other countries. So these four parameters make India the greenest country, even though, on the other hand, we saw that rivers are polluted, getting polluted in India also, and there are all kinds of other environmental issues. But overall, carbon footprint makes it, even today, the greenest country compared to other major economies, according to National Geographic Survey. They call it Green Index. That's what Green Index. Okay, now, the idea of food being, the choice of food is very, very important for much of Indians, most of Indians. So the animal meat, especially red meat, is a big issue in India. Probably those who do take meat will take probably egg or chicken. But beef is a very, almost like a holy cow is the word, right? Cow is holy, literally, for most of Indians. So cow meat is even McDonald's, wherever in India, they cannot sell beef. They cannot sell the steak or burger. They have to make it Maybe chicken is okay. Chicken is still sold in McDonald's in India, but definitely not beef. So why red meat is such a big issue? So to practice nonviolence starts with how people are relating to animals. That's the starting point. So animals, violence towards animals is a big problem, especially towards the cattle. So that makes it India the very careful in their food choices, and that keeps their carbon footprint very low. Because we know that much of the Amazonian forest, for example, as I already mentioned, that comes at a great cost, because that food is all going to the cattle, and that comes at a cost of the Amazonian forests that are being destroyed. Okay, now, so why people in India became vegetarians with the Buddha and Mahavira, which I mentioned in the beginning, 2600 years ago? Because the philosophy or cosmology of Jainism, for example, says that this is the Jain universe, by the way. We were talking about astronomy a little bit. This is the way Jains imagined their universe 2600 years ago. And they imagined this as the Earth. This is the shape of the universe in their cosmology. This is where the liberated souls live forever. So in their perspective, even probably Jesus and all the great prophets, the Buddha, Mahavira, they're all living here permanently. They always live. It's kind of like, you can probably compare it with, you can probably call it the Jain paradise or Jain heaven. So their souls are here forever in eternal peace, eternal energy, eternal for eternity. They will always be here eternally peaceful, eternally calm. So those are the souls here. We, the less of the mortals, are here on the planet, on the earth. And these are the hells below the earth, are the hells, seven hells, and seven heavens. So the abode of the liberated beings, the heavens, the earth, and the hells. That's the way the cosmology was imagined. So in the earth, on the earth, there are three continents, two oceans, where animals and humans are living, seven hells are below the earth, and eight heavens, I'm sorry. And so the beings in the universe, all the beings in the universe, everything has a soul. Even the earth and the air and fire was imagined as being a soul, a body with a soul. So earth-bodied beings, air-bodied beings, fire-bodied beings were mentioned in the Jain text. The only thing that is non-living is the karma particle. So karma is a particle that gets attached to our soul, and that pollutes our soul. So to attain, to be able to jump from earth to the liberated abode, our soul needs to be completely purified of all the dust particles that are caused by the karma particles. So karma is kind of a particle that gets attached to the soul, and that keeps our soul so heavy that it cannot rise up to reach the final frontier, and it remains stuck in this reincarnation cycle, and we keep getting rebirth either from earth to heaven, back to earth, or from earth to hell, back to earth, and so on. So this is the cycle of rebirth, which is commonly accepted in Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism. That's kind of a very similar idea of reincarnation. Okay? I hope it's not too heavy. So one's present can be others' past or future. So all the beings in the universe that we see, all the different species that we see, can be our relatives, maybe born in those species in this lifetime, and vice versa. So we can also be going into these cycles until infinity, until we all get liberated and reach the final frontier. That's the ultimate goal. But until we reach there, we're all stuck in this reincarnation cycle. That's the idea of reincarnation. Okay. Now, to see this view also from another perspective, Jains imagined that all the beings in the universe can be categorized into five categories. Those which have five senses, all the five senses, touch, taste, smell, see, and hear. Right? The five senses. So the birds can touch, taste, see, smell, and hear. Birds, reptiles, mammals like us, humans like us, gods and demons. So they were all put in one category. Then the least category is the touch only. The beings or the soul or living beings that have only one sense, the touch only. So that would be earth. So earth is a living being with a sense of touch in this philosophy. Water is a living being with a sense of touch. Fire and air These are the body, these are the beings with one sense of touch only. The Nikosa are one cell beings, those are also beings with one sense only, and then plants. So these are the beings that are that have only one sense, which is the sense of touch. But all of us have five senses: touch, taste, smell, see, and hear. So for humans to be able to survive, they were taught that they should consume only the beings that have only one sense of touch only. So for human survival, minimum of earth, minimum of water, minimum of fire, minimum of air or plants. Only those things should be consumed, nothing else. Right? So to consume another human being would be ultimate sin, or papa is the word in this language, or ultimate karma burden on the soul. So the burden on the soul is heaviest when we cause ultimate violence to another human being. That is accepted by all religions, right? Do not kill, do not steal, do not lie. But in this philosophy, to kill a human being is equal to killing a mammal or a reptile or a bird. All of those are equal. Is that clear? Right? So to kill a bird, to kill a mammal, kill a reptile or kill a human, everything is equally sinful, equal burden to the soul. So you get equal karma, heavy burden on the soul. So those things are to be avoided for human consumption. What can be consumed is only plant, air, fire, earth and water. And even those should be minimally consumed. Even plants that are growing underground, those plants cannot be consumed. So like carrot or potato or onion or garlic, because to consume those plants, you're causing violence to the entire plant, because those are the roots of the plants. So those plants cannot be consumed. Only the byproduct of a plant such as mango or banana or grain, rice, those are okay, but not the root of the plant, because that's again ultimate violence. So that's how they imagine. So that eventually made everybody accept this idea of non-violence, where it begins with how we treat our fellow human being, of course, but also our fellow mammals, fellow our other beings which have the same five senses of what I mentioned in this category. And then in the middle are the other rest of the beings which have two senses, three senses, or four senses. That's how this is the kind of a different taxonomy of the beings of the universe from Jain perspective. Okay, now then this is another, just the same thing but with another view. So the world consists of living beings and non-living beings. Now living beings can be of two types: liberated beings, which are the prophets and Buddhas and so on. Those are the liberated beings at the final frontier of the universe. The rest of us, the mundane beings, can be mobile beings or immobile beings. Now mobile beings can have two, three, four or five senses, and immobile beings are one sense beings that have earth, water, fire, air and plants. So only these things are to be consumed by humans for their survival. Okay, so Jain philosophy then can be, another way to look at Jain philosophy is the philosophy of triple A's, three A's: Ahimsa, Aparigraha and Anekantvad. Right? So Ahimsa, you might have heard this word a little bit, it gets used in English sometimes. Ahimsa simply means non-violence, which was the philosophy of Dr. Martin Luther King that he took from Gandhi, and Gandhi took it from Jainism. That's the greatest dharma for one's karma. So Ahimsa was equated with greatest dharma, greatest religion, the ultimate virtue, ultimate philosophy. That was the sort of the founding, foundational principle for this philosophy, is non-violence. Then Aparigraha. Aparigraha means that idea, the example that I gave you in the beginning, that the monks who renounce everything as they live in the world. By renouncing everything, by cutting down their accumulation, they are effectively cutting down their carbon footprint to the ultimate. Even householders, actually, in this community, even householders are supposed to have as less possessions as possible. So 10 shirts to 1 shirt, right? 3 cars to 1 car, and so on. So cutting down one's consumption of water, cutting down one's consumption of food and air and so on. And then Anekantvad is the idea of, if you have heard this parable of an elephant with 6 blind men trying to touch an elephant. Now each touches a different part of the elephant and thinks he or she is the perfect perspective. one who touches the tail of the elephant thinks elephant is like a tail, like a hairy stuff, like a hairy, hairy animal. One who touches the belly of the elephant feels that elephant is like a big ball. Right? One who touches the tusk of the elephant thinks elephant is like a very sharp animal, and so on. But the truth is that we need to combine all the perspectives to reach the final truth. Swanikandvad is kind of based on a similar idea that everybody has different perspectives towards one final truth, and we need to all combine different ideas to be able to reach the final. So nobody is perfectly right, perfectly wrong, but everybody is partially right, partially wrong. We need to accept and combine all of these ideas. So applying that to the environment, we usually apply our human perspective towards the environment. But Jainism says that human perspective is just one of the perspectives, and animals have their own perspective. So we should be able to combine even their perspectives. So to give an example, to give a really startlingly different ideas of the environment, how do we see it and how Indians still are seeing it. So on our highways, national highways, I don't know if you noticed, but can we walk on our national highways? The pedestrians are not allowed, right? On that, it's a crime. It's almost there's a fine. If any loitering is not allowed on our national highways, right? Now, so humans are not allowed on national highways in America. Now, when I was doing my research for the second book, I was driving across the Himalayas. There, I've seen big signs. There are signs on national highways that you need to stop if you see an elephant on the national highway. So elephants are allowed on the national highways in a culture like India, where you know humans do not have monopoly on national highway, or not just elephants, but camels and cattle, of course, and all kinds of animals. So those are all accepted even on the national highways. So that's just two extreme examples that humans are not allowed here, and even animals are allowed here, there on the national highway. So kind of one small example that how this Anikandwar idea can be applied to see how animals are equal, and if not equal, even more right to use our land, because they were probably before us, or everywhere where we are now. So it's anthropocentric or egocentric to say that the reality exists in pluralistic way, right? And the only reality that exists in the world is the reality of plurality, that there is no one true perspective, so to speak, but there are multiple perspectives, and that's the final reality, the reality of the multiplicity. Okay. So the great teacher that I mentioned, especially the 24th great teacher, Mahavira, who was a contemporary of the Buddha, he spoke of these, he practiced these ideas to the ultimate, the non-violence, and as he was passing away, as he was dying, when he was having his last breath, he sent his first chosen disciple away from him to stop slaughter of some animals. So even at his last moment, he was very compassionate and very aware to stop the violence. So that's one example of how he practiced non-violence. And in his teachings, he said these things like, trees are inherently valuable, vegetation has life just as humans. Imagine 2600 years ago, long before science said that plants have life, Mahavira had said the same sentence that plants have life, just as humans have. Then before him was another teacher, and he also responds to the burning of snake. Out of compassion for the snake, he renounces his wealth and becomes a monk from being a prince to becoming a monk because of out of compassion. And similarly, the earlier teacher. The other text of Jainism also says similar things, that souls render service to one another, helping each other. Behavior of the bees. The humans should live like bees by taking only the small nectar, not destroying the flower itself or not destroying the plant itself, but take very small nectar from each flower, and that's how we should live. The forests are like sage trees to be planted for positive karma. These are the ideas that come from these texts. Now then, householders, those who are not monks or nuns, householders also have tried to live their life as much as possible by doing minimum violence. You cannot have 100% non-violent life, but to minimize the violence. So Jain householders will rarely be involved in charcoal trading or timber trading, animal pulling in a cart, or alcohol trading, slave trading, weapons trading, poisons trading, all kinds of these kind of professions will be avoided by, have been avoided by Jain householders over millennia. What they will do is maybe trading, banking, commercial activities, clerical activities, traditional medicines, arts and crafts, clerical jobs, textile or machinery kind of work, publishing and media or education. Less violent. We cannot say they are 100% non-violent, but less violent compared to these tangible or obvious violence is how they have tried to live their life for thousands of years.
Aim it at the computer.
Then I was comparing this in this couple of next slides. I'm just comparing Jain ideas with contemporary Western philosophers like Brian Smith. And Brian Smith says that most of our depression today in our modern westernized life, and when I say westernized, even Indian cities are now westernized, so I'm not saying it geographically, but the way we live, even Indian cities like Delhi or Bombay, so most of our depression in westernized societies is because of consumerism. And consumerism comes from our attachment to material objects. That's what Brian Smith had said. And that compares very well with Jain Aparigraha, non-accumulation, where the idea is to minimize our possessions, minimize our attachment to material objects. Also, he said, Earth is alive, and Earth responds to our presence. That compares pretty well with Jain ideas. And also, he said that we should all celebrate our common origin, because we all came out of Big Bang phenomenon that happened billions of years ago. So we all are connected by that token also. That can be compared with Jain respect for all beings in the universe. Then two more Western philosophers, Thomas Berry and David Abram. And Berry says that world is a communion of subjects, not a collection of objects. Everything in the world has its own agency. It's not a dead object to be consumed by humans. And that can be compared with Jain view of soul in all beings, fire, water, air, and earth. Everything has a soul. So it has agency, it is alive, it responds to our presence and so on. Abram says that diversity of local forms, that compares well with Jain insistence of changing lifestyle, changing minds, trees as inherently valuable for beauty and strength, and role of senses can be compared with empiricism, that senses are equally important to observe and to change our behavior to make it more non-violent. Of course, the greatest or the most popular figure that practiced nonviolence remains of Gandhi. And Gandhi was inspired by these ideas of Jain philosophy. His guru was Raj Chandra. With him, he corresponded for 6 years. When he was in South Africa, he became a barrister, a lawyer in UK, in England. Then he practiced his law in South Africa. In South Africa, he became more activist for civil rights in South Africa. And from South Africa, he wrote letters to this Indian guru called Raj Chandra from 1891 to 95. In those letters, he was more and more convinced about Jain philosophy, and he adopted several of the ideas from Jain philosophy and also Hindu philosophy, but the Jain ideas that he took in his own lifestyle were truth, the satya, non-violence, the ahimsa, simplicity, aparigraha, non-accumulation, renunciation, celibacy, brahmacharya, self-reliance, purushartha, and austerities, upavasa and fasting and those things that he practiced throughout his life. So to take some examples from his own life, we can see that Gandhi's life can be seen as an ecological treatise, a living ecosystem. Gandhi himself lived a life that took several ideas from Jainism and Hinduism. And ideas such as his own meals, his own diet consisted of nuts and fruits, very small, minimal consumption of food. Even food was very minimal in his consumption. He did his yoga and meditation every day, daily ablutions, his rituals, his bodily practices such as yoga. His periodic observances of silence. You know, today we all have heard meditation is to silence our minds. But Gandhi practiced meditation, but he also practiced silence of speech. Go silent, completely mute for days and days. The cut down of speech, cut down of violence. Most of our violence comes out of our speaking. So Gandhi practiced that also, which also is practiced by Jain monks and nuns. Morning walks. His walking was itself a form of meditation, as he did the miles and miles of walking, and even some movement that he led were based on walking. Cultivation of the small with the big. even in the middle of the big meetings, national meetings, he's fighting with the British, non-violently fighting with the British. But even in those moments, he would always be very aware of small animals and take care of the animals first, some small goat. Or if you've seen a Hollywood film, Gandhi, there are some scenes where he will first take care of the goat and then come back and continue with the meeting with the national leaders and so on. Spinning of the wheel. Gandhi was so self-reliant. Today we use these words, self-reliance and so on. But Gandhi was probably one of the first or earliest kind of apostle of self-reliance, where he made his own clothes. That became a national movement within India. Thousands of people, millions of people also made their own clothes as a statement against the British policies of exploitation of Indian farmers and so on, and cotton farmers and so on. So Gandhi was the first one, one of the first one at least, to really practice that self-reliance, and that changed the lifestyle of Indians at a massive level. And that was a big shock to Indian, to the British policies of exploitation of the farmers and whatnot. And we're also based. So Gandhi, there's an example where Gandhi loses his sleep for the entire night. Why? Because apparently his son has lost a piece of pencil. And Gandhi could not really understand where did I go wrong that my son does not understand the importance of a small piece of pencil. Why waste even that small piece of pencil? That kind of ultimate form of self-reliance and all the austerities and whatnot, simplicity and whatnot that he practiced across for many, many decades while I was in India. So today the moralists, non-violent activists, feminists, journalists, social reformers, trade union leaders, peasants, prohibitionists, nature cure lovers, renouncers and environmentalists have all taken inspirations from Gandhi's life, and that's probably the biggest statement of the relevance of Jain philosophy and Hindu philosophy also, non-violence especially, that was an inspiration to Dr. King, to Nelson Mandela in South Africa and across the world. And so. But Gandhi himself also took some inspiration from S.D. Thoreau, or the transcendentalist of Boston area. So there was a very interesting exchange of ideas from ancient Indian philosophy to transcendentalist S.D. Thoreau and immersion, from S.D. Thoreau to Gandhi, and from Gandhi back to Dr. King. A very interesting flow of ideas that changed the I think countries for better, for really betterment, for India and United States. And how much time I have? I can go on and on, but
10 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. Some more examples of how Indian rulers have practiced nonviolence towards even plants and forests. So there was a famous emperor, a Buddhist emperor actually, Ashoka, and he created these edicts across India, thousands of miles apart. But these huge edicts, they celebrate the sacredness and compassion towards animals and plants. So he practiced those ideas also when he was living, again, more than 2,000 years ago. And Ashoka's grandfather becomes a Jain monk, and when he passes away, and his grandson also becomes very non-violent and practices those ideas. Other emperors such as Siddharaja and Kumarwal, these are again historical figures and those who practice similar ideas. Then there are ideas of sacred groves across India even today. There are thousands of these kind of, like our national parks, where we are not allowed to cut even a small tree, right, in our national parks. So these are the smaller versions of national parks, but with sacredness in built into it. So these are the sacred groves across India where nobody will ever cut even a small branch from any tree, because that forest is sacred. So that's another way to practice non-violence and compassion towards the plants and forests. And even the Islamic emperors, very interestingly, they also become partially vegetarians. You know, their food consists mainly of meat, even today. But the Jain monks, they go to their courts in Delhi, and they convince them to accept non-violence, at least vegetarianism, at least once a month or so on, and several Islamic emperors also adopt vegetarianism and non-violence because of the influence of Jain monks. Okay, what are Jains doing today? Not as ideal as one would hope. Jains today do get into industries that are causing pollution to the environment, not good. They are also into strip mining industries, not good as well. Wastage of resources is happening today in some of the big, for example, Indian weddings are huge, so all kinds of food and resources are wasted, not an ideal picture, and probably Jains should take inspiration, more inspiration from their own ideas. But on the other hand, there are still some positive examples, such as cattle sanctuaries. So any sick cow or any aged cow, instead of slaughtering it, they can be sent to these sanctuaries, and those sanctuaries are funded, supported by Jains and some Hindus as well. So those are the cattle sanctuaries. There are again hundreds of sanctuaries across India where animals are taken care of with all the compassion and all the care that they need. And there is an interesting bird hospital in Delhi, where because of the ceiling fans in India, across India there are these ceiling fans, and birds can sometimes get entangled in these fans and they get injured. So birds can be brought to this particular hospital in Delhi, middle of the city, and those birds are given this treatment and again as a token for of compassion and so on. So those are some ways, still some examples of non-violence compassion that's still being practiced, but it has to happen more and more across the community. Now, when Jains come to this country, North America, there are at least 100,000 Jains now in the United States, at least. There are no official figures because we don't count religions in this country, we count by race. So there are 3 million people of Indian origin or Hindu Americans. So by some estimate, probably 10% or more, so maybe 300,000 maybe Jains within that Indian American population. When they come to this country, they de-emphasize rituals and asceticism. Non-sectarian and interfaith approaches are highlighted. Meditation is highlighted. Vegetarianism takes the form of animal rights, so many of them will work with entities such as PETA, people against people for ethical treatment of animals, PETA. Environmentalism becomes more social-centric rather than only spiritual. And several of the traditional stories become more ecologized, so they try to interpret in terms of ecology and environmentalism. Some more temples in North America. Our own city, Dallas, has a pretty large Jain temple that has gone green in some ways at least. They have replaced their energy equipment and have received some grants and so on, and so they're trying to save some carbon footprint there by that approach. Other temples have taken a similar approach. In Detroit, for example, they are going green in some ways. And Indian temples also are trying to grow more plants and trying to cut down their carbon footprint in some examples of that. And that's pretty much my slide, my presentation, and I'll be happy to take your questions.
Okay, any questions?
Yeah.
You talked of rebirth at the beginning, mm-hmm. and there are three levels, paradise and human beings and hell.
Right.
Can anybody go through all three? Paradise is final, that's fine.
Right.
But from human, can they go to hell and go back to human and then to paradise?
Yes. So to be able to reach the... So there are two words now, paradise and heavens. There are eight heavens between earth and the ultimate. So let's call it final frontier. That's not what, you know, paradise and heaven become confusing. So to be able to reach final frontier, one must be born as a human. So from human, only humans can shed off their karma particles, purify their soul. That will take them to the final frontier of the moksha. That's actually the technical word is moksha, liberation. Right? So liberation abode or moksha dharma or moksha. Abode of the liberated souls can be approached only as a human being. So from hell, one must come back to the earth. Even from the heavens, one must come back to the earth. Only from earth, as a human being, one can reach the final frontier of the liberated beings.
Will presented the hierarchy of the,
right.
of the different
mm-hmm.
animals, plants, non-organic things.
Right.
It was based on the number of senses.
Yes.
And I was curious what the rationale behind that was. I mean, it seems to suggest that a blind person is worth less than a person who's not blind. So I'm just curious why senses.
Right. So now, there was a slide. Let's take a look at the slide again. So yeah. So right. So if you notice, humans are just humans. So even if any human is a blind or mute or deaf, he or she would still be at this category. So he or she would be equal to gods, demons, mammals, reptiles and birds in terms of five senses. So those are the most crucial to practice non-violence. So anybody who kills any of these things causes the heaviest burden on his or her soul. Right? So to be able to live, you must consume only one sense beings. That's the idea. To be able to practice non-violence, with this idea that we have five senses, similarly mammals have five senses, reptiles have five senses, and birds also have five senses. So they are equal to us in that way. They also feel pain when, just as we want to live, we don't want to die, nobody wants to die, even if we are suffering, but we still want to live, we do experience pain. Similarly, birds and reptiles and mammals also experience similarly extreme pain when anybody causes harm to them. That's the idea. Equality of pain. But these things do not, at least as how they imagine it, that these things probably do not have that kind of an extreme pain that we experience more and more. So, you know, they have only one sense of touch only. So, even though this is also violence, but to be able to live in this world, we have to consume something. We just cannot stop we cannot stop completely. We have to consume something. So that something must come as with utmost care, even at that level, one must consume with utmost care, minimizing the consumption of even earth, water, fire and earth. So fire example, to give an example, after sunset, nothing, no activity at all after sunset. No eating, no drinking, no water consumption, because to be able to do anything after the sunset in the evening, we will have to switch on all the lights like we have in this room right now. So that was the level of cutting down the consumption. Let's not cause violence even to fire. The more fire we light, more violence we do, more consumption we do. That's kind of an ultimate consumption day practice.
It's on? Okay.
Yeah.
In terms of our impact on the environment, one of the things that we do that has the greatest impact on the environment, especially in the West, is to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're extremely worried about your personal impact on the environment through your reproductive choices, of course, you can choose to be celibate. But I think that being a responsible householder, in other words, not having more children than you can support, and not having more than the ecology can support, is a path through life that requires great discrimination and discipline. So in my mind, a responsible householder and a celibate person, a brahmacharya, are morally equal. But I get the impression from a lot of Dharmic religions that the ideal actually is the celibate person, and the householder is morally lesser than a celibate person.
Right.
Could you comment on this,
please?
That's
a great question, yeah. Right, so yes, so in this philosophy especially, the most ideal is a brahmachari, the monk or a nun, because they have renounced everything. They have renounced all kinds of possessions. They can practice non-violence to the ultimate, because they do not possess anything, so they cannot do violence to anything or anybody. Right? But householders, not just reproduction, but daily living, wage, earning the wage and so on, it will cause some violence. So that's one difference, because level of violence and non-violence. So that's why the monk or nun is the ultimate example, ultimate role model. So all householders must become a monk or a nun so that they can achieve the moksha or the liberation. Because that's how you can cut down the violence. Does that answer your question? Or probably you had some more.
No, it's okay. What you're saying is that the life of a householder is inherently more complicated and necessarily involves more violence.
Yes.
So if your moral distinction is primarily based on ahimsa, not farming, just being a householder necessarily entails more violence,
yes.
So
yes.
It's less desirable.
Yeah, right. Okay. That's the gradation. The violence and non-violence.
Okay,
it's a spectrum of, yeah. Yeah.
You talked about how karma accumulates on the soul through violence. How do you liberate the soul of karma?
It's a great question. Yeah, I didn't even touch on this. That's a great question. And the, one of the best or the most commonly accepted ways in this community especially is to either to become completely monk or a nun. That really cut down one's violence, because one will cut down their consumption, their possession and all of that. But even as a householder, they do all kinds of penance and austere practices such as fasting or not eating after sunset or drinking water with utmost care. Filter the water, then feed that water into any filtering system that we have, so that at least the insects or microbes or bugs are all filtered out before we start killing them by our filtration process. So really cutting down the violence again is one of the best way to really purify the soul. So becoming vegetarian from being a non-vegetarian or becoming vegan, if one is already vegetarian, one should become vegan, because milk also comes at a great violence in this country especially. We know how our cattle are treated in slaughterhouses and whatnot. Even to raise the milk, it causes all kinds of violence. So that's one of the ways to really... Purification means non-violently living, and that comes when we cut down our activities, our possessions, our consumptions. Yes, sir?
A little different question.
Sure.
I'm sure being a Jain, living in the U.S., especially raising children. And so could you just sort of comment about how Jains in the U.S. deal with the materialism, the consumerism in this environment?
Yes, that's a good personal kind of question. I have two kids, and my wife and I we have to really get into sometimes arguments with kids try to convince my oldest son, who is now a teenager, he's a college student, so he wants a new car. And my request, I can only request him or suggest him that instead of, when you want to think of a car, why not think of an electric car with your zero carbon footprint, zero emission? Because we at our house, we have 100% renewable energy. We have from wind energy. So even if you're charging that electric car, you're causing zero carbon footprint. So that can be one example statement for the environment. But it's taking him time to get convinced. He still wants a big car with all the horsepower and whatnot. So that's a kind of our daily intellectual debate we have. But food, when it comes to food, thankfully they are already very strictly vegetarians. They are already convinced that it's extreme violence to eat meat, but also health risk. Red meat is one of the biggest health risks as we know now. And then health, and then planet's health and our own health. So food choices, they've already maintained their lifestyle. Then as I mentioned, there are almost all big cities in America, they have this big Jain temple where there are Sunday schools. So we have been taking our kids to these Sunday schools, so they have at least some indirect teaching to see the alternative perspective, because the rest of the days they're as Americans as they can be. I mean, they are born here, so they are Americans, but at least once a week, they get this alternative perspective that there's a different philosophy to live also, which people in India have been living in. That's now have all these additional benefits to the planet and to our own health. So it takes some work to keep this balance, to raise them as Americans. Yeah, so Jain Americans. Yeah.
In Jainism, is there no consideration at all of the... In Jainism, is there no consideration given at all to the development of a brain, and how some, even in these categories, a human being has a brain that is so far developed than any of the other, maybe not to the gods, but...
Right, that's a great question again, which is something that I didn't really touch, but I'm happy to touch upon it now. That, remember, there was a question that how do you reach that moksha land or the land of the liberated beings? That can be reached only from being a human being. Even though humans are equal to reptiles and birds and mammals when it comes to non-violence and violence, but to be able to reach, to let's say to become a Mahavira or the Buddha, only humans can become, because of our rationality, we can decide what we want to, how we want to live our life. We are not just guided by our instincts, but we are also intelligent beings. Our intuitions and intelligence do separate us from other beings. So only humans can, at least not, at least what they imagine, that only humans can do, for example, yoga or meditation, or they can choose to become vegetarians. Other beings in the universe probably cannot really make the distinction. We can debate that, but that's how at least they imagined 2600 years ago. Now, with the latest research, we know that, you know, at least partially, plants also are as intelligent, or not, probably not as intelligent as human beings, but they do have some intelligence. But at that time, they treated plants to be of equal weightage to the earth and fire and air. So yes, humans were treated, especially because of their intuitions and intelligence, and that's how they can become Mahavira.
Non-violence is a guiding principle. What is the role, if any, of beneficence?
So,
beneficence.
Like as a charity?
Or obligation to do good.
Right, so non-violence is the guiding principle even for that.
The beneficence, physicians, for example, use a lot of resources to cure a patient.
Uh-huh.
They're being beneficent, but they're wasting resources.
Oh.
They're creating violence to the environment to cure a patient. How is genesis happening?
Right, right. Because probably it would be a... You need to, one will have to weigh out the pros and cons if by some consumption of resources it brings more non-violence and compassion and peace to the world. If the motive is really, so it would be, you know, it would be a debate which one is to be given more weightage. But the ultimate, for monks and nuns, non-violence will be the guiding light. So if they are sitting in, let's say, in the deep meditation, they would not even see the pain and suffering in the world because they are into their own soul, they are into their own meditation. They are trying to become soul only without completely ignoring the rest of the world. In that state, their goal is to become Mahavira Buddha without really caring for anybody else. Right? But once they are out of their meditation, when they are like you and me, then that time their approach is to have compassion and non-violence to every being in the universe, not just humans, but every part of the universe. In that realm, yes, that perspective will be equally important to bring comfort and to bring caring to as many people as possible. So it would be a daily decision which one to give more importance.
Thank you very much. As a token of our appreciation, we'd like to present you this mug of Raphael's Philosopher's Forum.
Oh, yeah. Sophia Westwitz. Thank you.
All right.
Hello.